Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is John Ramo, and I'm a host on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Professor Carla Hubner on her new monograph, Magnetic Woman, Toyin and the Surrealist Erotic, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2020. Professor Hubner is professor of art history and affiliate faculty in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program at Wright State University. She is also the current president of the Czechoslovak Studies Association, and the author of numerous articles on visual culture, gender and sexuality, periodical culture, and more in Central European contexts. Finally, Professor Hubner is a novelist and creative writer herself, with new work set to appear shortly with Regal House. Professor Hubner's work indeed shows a keen artistic, literary, and historical eye in her study of the Czech artist Marie Cheminova, better known as Toyin. Born in 1902 and passing away in 1980, the Czech surrealist Toyin experienced a tumultuous century in full. Her life and art reflected various international avant-garde movements in Czechoslovakia's First Republic and in post-war Paris. As Hubner demonstrates in Magnetic Woman, Toyin's ambiguous sexuality complemented a social and artistic fluidity. Importantly, Toyin spoke in the masculine gender in Czech, while friends and colleagues referred to her in the feminine. That is, Toyin straddled gender in every aspect of her personal life. And so too did her artwork, crossing between different media as much as sexuality and gender. In the interview that follows, we speak of Toyin in the feminine, even as Professor Hubner discusses how this fundamental ambiguity characterized her eroticism. In her telling, it is Toyin's achievement that this ambiguous eroticism earned her entrance to various cultural, intellectual, and social milieu. Simultaneously, Toyin's eroticism distinguished her life and artwork from her peers and contemporaries. Professor Hubner's expert selection and analyses of Toyin's artwork give equal weight to these accomplishments, yielding a beautifully illustrated monograph. It's my pleasure as a historian and as an art lover to speak with her today. I hope you enjoy our interview. Professor Hubner, thank you so much for speaking with us today on this fascinating book devoted to Marie Cheminova, the wonderful Czech artist both professionally and personally known as Toyin throughout her life from 1902 to 1980. Before we begin speaking about Toyin, however, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about yourself as an art historian, as well as an historian more broadly speaking of Czech culture. What led you to this field?
Well, there are a number of different things that kind of led me in this direction. For one thing, we could say that when I was a kid, I was one of those kids that drew a lot. So people tended to think I was going to become an artist, but I did not go in that direction. Instead, I went toward writing and somewhat toward theater. But eventually, I began to be writing a lot about art and decided that it was time to go back to school and do a graduate degree. And at first, I thought I might do history because I'm interested in such a wide range of different things. And I looked at, because it was close by, UC Berkeley's offerings in history, and I thought, oh, they all seem to be on political and economic history. Those are not the areas of history that interest me tremendously. Maybe I should think about art history. And so that kind of led me into ultimately getting my PhD in art history while continuing to be interested in lots of different areas of history. In terms of Czech culture, I have sort of a family connection, not a genealogical connection to Czechoslovakia, but a family friend kind of connection. And so naturally, since not that many people who don't have Czech ancestors are drawn to Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic, that was kind of intriguing to me, and I wanted to know more about it. So those are kind of the things that led me in this direction.
And now, within your studies, how did you first encounter or hear of Toyin? Myself, I heard about her first studying the history of the book, but she seems to be an interesting artist in terms of how often she pops up for people and how they actually encounter her. So what led you to Toyin?
I actually encountered Toyin first back in the 90s when I was reading Whitney Chadwick's Women Artists in the Surrealist Movement. This was around the time that I was really starting to write about art. And I was intrigued that here was this Czech surrealist, a surrealist woman, somebody that was doing erotica. There were just a lot of different things that piqued my interest. And so then later, when I was starting my PhD, my advisor, Barbara McCloskey, and I were trying to figure out, well, all right, what exactly is my research topic going to be? We were looking a little bit at Weimar Germany and not finding anything that really grabbed us as not having been done yet. And Barbara said, well, what about that Czech surrealist that you're interested in? Can you do a dissertation on her? And I said, yeah, that would be great. I'll need to improve my Czech some, but that's kind of how that went. And I've never regretted it. I've always enjoyed the research. It's been just, you know, really fun learning more, not just about Toyin and the Czech surrealists, but about Czech modernism and Czech culture more generally.
And this is one of the delights of your book, but it really opens up a sort of world around Toyin as well. And it's really a close contextual work that you do, I think, that reconstructs her various milieu from pre-war Prague to Paris, and then to her career in post-war Paris as well. And in your telling, Toyin seems at times an almost wholly typical figure in terms of a parity with her male colleagues, especially her close collaborator, Jindřich Štýrský, in terms of recognition, participation, connectedness, for lack of a better word, and then at times by virtue of her ambiguous sexuality, she seems to occupy a very anomalous position at the same time as representing a generation in different ways. And here, I think the virtue of your book rests in how you work within archival constraints of available evidence, persuasive reconstructions of relationships, and then close formal analyses of her artwork. Can you comment a bit then on these dual tensions, that is, Toyin as both representative and unrepresentative in a sense of a generation, milieu, and what can be said and cannot be said in terms of reconstructing her career?
Well, I think this thing of Toyin being both representative and unrepresentative is something that's really important, because she's representative in a lot of ways, in that she's one of a generation of young Czech women growing up at a time when Czech feminism was very strong, when women were getting a lot of new opportunities, when women were starting to enter politics in the Czech lands, even before the formation of Czechoslovakia as a country. And so she's from this generation that is seeing all kinds of feminist progress and opportunities for women, and you know, more opportunities for education and jobs and so forth. And so things are really opening up for women. And at the same time, you know, she's somebody who can really kind of presents herself as gender ambiguous and is known for having spoken in the masculine gender in Czech. I don't think that was the case for her French speaking, but she was known for speaking in the masculine gender in Czech, which was very surprising to people, and would not have been easy for someone to kind of get used to doing if they hadn't been doing that since early childhood. And also, while Czech women in the 20s and 30s were able to wear trousers and, you know, wear what would seem as kind of more masculine styled clothing. And in fact, in the 1920s, there was a lot of, you know, the short hair, the wearing of pants and so forth. And that was pretty high fashion. But it was also seen as, it was also seen as kind of gender rebellious. And Toyin definitely took that further and, you know, with the ungendered pseudonym. And so that was something that was very non-representative of her generation. She also kind of fits into both in a typical and an atypical way in terms of some of the sexual politics and gender politics of the 20s and 30s and how there's this development in sex education and sex reform in a lot of different countries, including Czechoslovakia. So she offers a lot of interesting things in terms of this placement of her in an almost entirely male avant-garde group, her acceptance by these male members of the avant-garde group, on the one hand, she's not a conventional woman. On the other hand, a lot of the males in the group are drawn to her and you know, kind of have, you know, unrequited attractions to her and so forth. It's really quite quite interesting and complicated. So those are some of the ways in which I'm seeing her as being both representative and very different in her time period, particularly in Czechoslovakia. In France, it's a whole different thing, I think. But specifically in Czechoslovakia in the 20s and 30s, that's, you know, she's a really interesting example of someone who comes out of this opening up of sex and gender possibilities and then goes beyond what most people are doing.
Now, if there's one thing we all know from studying the avant-garde, it's that male artists and writers leave reams and reams of written text, traces, memoirs. It's a little different with Toyin in this book. Can you describe a little bit about your work with Toyin on both, with what sources you used, secondary as well as archival? And here I would also ask that, as you shift throughout your monograph, if you could comment a little on how Toyin located herself on several fault lines, generationally, in terms of gender, nationally, linguistically, and also artistically between movements as well as mediums. You touch a little bit on this in the book's first chapter, The Myth of Toyin, as well as a really wonderful accompanying bibliographical essay at the end of the book. So briefly put, it seems that there were archival challenges and also various receptions over time. Would it be fair to say in this regard that she has posed and continues to pose any unique challenges for scholars? And how would you describe these receptions that you perhaps work through for your own book?
Okay, well, that's a big chunk of stuff to discuss. But first off, I think I would say that I think the challenges that Toyin presented in terms of research were not necessarily all that unique. That yes, there was a paucity of actual texts by Toyin. For instance, when Toyin would send someone a postcard or something, it usually would just be kind of like, you know, signing the postcard or, you know, sort of saying hi and then signing it with four other people. And then there's a little bit of business correspondence about, yes, it will cost you this much if I design you a book plate. But I don't think that's unique to Toyin. I think there are a lot of cultural figures who, for one reason or another, we don't have a lot of personal materials in terms of texts. And I think that is more common among women artists, especially from earlier periods, not so much for the 20th century, but where, as feminist art historians, starting with the 1970s, really started to excavate the history of many of these female artists, that we were exploring them through their contents or their contacts. And so looking at, you know, their friends, their neighbors, their relatives, finding out what those people said and what they thought. And so to a certain extent, that was what I was doing with Toyin. Toyin did not like to write down things, but Toyin had friends who were, many of them were writers, and even the ones that were not writers often wrote quite a bit. And so a lot of my investigation of what Toyin might have thought about different things came through reading what her various friends, both male and female, had to say. So for instance, we can hypothesize some of Toyin's attitudes about 70s and 80s feminism through her friend Annie LeBrun and her writings. We don't know that Toyin's feelings were exactly the same, but they probably had a lot in common. Likewise, some of her ideas about other things, we can look at the writings of Shtirsky or Carl Taiga, Yaroslav Seifert, Vyacheslav Nezval, later on André Breton. Obviously, she's not going to agree with everything that her friends had to say. You know, one doesn't always agree with one's friends on every topic, but I think they do give some sense of what she might have been thinking on a lot of things. And we want to think too about the fact that she, while she didn't write to any extent, she was very much involved in conversations with people. And I'll probably be returning to that again with other questions that you ask. But we know that she did enjoy conversations with these various friends. And I don't think people were generally taking notes on what was said. And so this is kind of an unretrievable mass of stuff. So in addition to looking at things that were written by her friends, colleagues, other people in the periods and places that she was alive, I was also looking at a lot of kind of much more secondary stuff, reading a lot of periodicals that were published by various Czechs during the 20s and 30s, because the Czechs were just pouring forth endless numbers of periodicals on every topic you could imagine. So I was looking at, popular magazines, women's magazines, literary magazines, some political magazines and newspapers, feminist periodicals, sex reform periodicals, whatever I could run across that seemed like it might possibly shed some light on either Toyin's thinking or on just the world that she was living in. And I'm sure there is way more out there that I did not yet get to, but I looked at a lot of stuff from a lot of different perspectives. And that's something that I would say, you know, for people that are just beginning their researches on topics, you know, often a person feels like, oh, you know, I didn't find something on my specific topic. And I would always counsel people, you know, cast a broad net in terms of your researches, because you can find the, you know, most unexpected things in the most unexpected places. And, you know, not narrow, you know, having a narrow research focus is one thing, but it's good to have a broad net to pull in all that useful stuff. So moving on from that aspect of the question to how Toyin was received at different times. In the 1920s and 30s, Toyin was kind of seen as one of what Jindřich Chalupecký, one of the major critics, who was quite young at that time, thought of as the established avant-garde in Czechoslovakia. So on the one hand, that's not to say everyone liked or was interested in her work, but she was seen as somebody who was one of the movers and shakers in the cultural world at that time, that she couldn't be ignored. And then once World War II had taken place and she had moved to Paris and was with the Paris Surrealist group, then you get into a whole period of when Czechoslovakia had become communist, And on the one hand, some of the interwar avant-garde had become communist because a lot of them had been already, but much of what was happening in the interwar period was being rejected, particularly things like surrealism, because the post-war communists were really focused more on socialist realism. And so the whole surrealist group in Czechoslovakia kind of got left behind a bit. There continued to be a Czechoslovak surrealist group, but mostly younger people. And with, I think, kind of a different, you know, instead of being the sort of avant-garde that was in everybody's view, the post-war group is much more an underground group. And so you don't have a whole lot of scholarship and art criticism and so forth during the communist period in Czechoslovakia dealing with Toyin or the rest of the Prague surrealist group. You have some stuff coming up in French writing, not a whole lot. And then it's more been in kind of since the Velvet Revolution and the fall of communism that you start having scholars in Czechoslovakia that are looking at the Prague surrealist group, including Toyin. And then you also have scholars from other countries that are having more access to the Czech sources. You know, more and more of us are learning Czech, and also people are starting to delve more into the French sources. So I don't know that so much that viewpoints about Toyin have changed so much as that there's either kind of an avoidance of dealing with surrealism, and then other periods when surrealism is more seen as an interesting okay topic, as opposed to something that people were seeing as, oh, it's outmoded and it's not sufficiently communist or leftist or non-representational or whatever. So you have these fashions in scholarship, and more recently surrealism and Czech art in general are more in fashion than they were for a while.
And here your choice of a subject just seems absolutely perfectly suited to just tracking even the role of the place that surrealism had for other artists, how it changed over the course of the 20th century. And speaking of a broad net, I was very impressed with how the book Magnetic Woman masterfully traces various intellectual influences, receptions, as you just discussed, professional and personal relationships, which we've talked upon a bit about, visual languages, not only Toyin's, but also those of her collaborator, Shchirsky, as well as many surrealist colleagues. And as I was reading the book, I began to keep a list of the various artistic movements mapping on to Toyin's life and her contexts. We have the Dvietzil group, poetism, artificialism, anticipations of and adoptions of various schools of French surrealism, Czech surrealism in turn, French surrealism in the sense that it was practiced by Czech artists and writers in Prague, above all, then French surrealism as practiced in Paris, and then in Toyin's case, as you really intriguingly suggest, even hints of pop and op art in her later career, and what you also term a late imagery of desire, pardon me. So in broader terms then, is it perhaps possible to characterize Toyin's career in terms of ruptures, breaks, overlapping transitions, continuities? Is there a line through her whole career, or is it something a little more complicated?
Well, I think that in terms of themes, there are definitely themes that really go through her entire career. So for instance, the interest in the erotic, this is something that we see way at the beginning of her career, that even before she's really known at all as an artist, she's doing a canvas that is an orgy scene. And that she continues this interest in the erotic throughout the rest of her life. I mean, that in her later years in Paris, apparently she went to porn films on a regular basis. So sexuality in its many forms is a big theme throughout her art, throughout her life. but it shows up in different ways at different periods in her art. And there are times when it's less visible in her art. So that's one of the things that there is continuity in, even though stylistically there's not a continuity for that. Also, I'm finding, and this is something that I really did not go into in the book, but that I'm starting to look at a little bit more, is the use of various kinds of esoteric ideas in her art. The French surrealists post-war became much more involved in that, and definitely some of them were seeing her as an artist who made works that even could be considered as initiatory. But I'm thinking that even in her early work during the artificialist period, that we start to get some hints of that. That's something I can't discuss quite as much at this point. I'm working on a conference paper that I'm going to give in November that deals a bit more with this, but that's something that I'm seeing as possibly something that is also a continuity in her work. Now, stylistically, she definitely has different stages. So, you know, very early on, we see her doing work that, you know, is clearly influenced by what she was studying in school and, you know, learning about cubism and so forth, purism. There's not a lot of that, but then she goes through this period that's often referred to as her primitivist work, that's more focused on ideas from popular culture and naive art. Again, that's not something that lasts real long, but there's maybe more work relating to that. And then she and Shtirsky come up with this two-person movement called artificialism, which kind of comes under the umbrella of the Devyatsil group and poetism. But Devyatsil is a big group. It had many different currents throughout its approximately 10-year lifespan. Members of the Devyatsil group did a lot of different things, didn't all agree with one another on different stuff. So you could kind of say that artificialism is part of Devyatsil, and it's also in some ways not. And with artificialism, they're coming close to surrealism, but they're claiming that they're not surrealists. They're very much involved in a lyrical kind of abstraction, dealing with memory and reflection, but not direct representation of memories. They're really trying to get kind of start with memories and then go far away from them. And then they move more towards surrealism and decide to become surrealists in 1934. And then Toyin's work shifts somewhat stylistically and in terms of subject matter, and we start seeing a lot of imagery of phantoms and ghosts and cracking and fissuring. And then as time goes on, you know, again, she changes styles as she's exploring different things. She's a very diverse artist in terms of her working with medium, in terms of her stylistic choices at different times in her life. I mean, she's someone that's not purely a painter in terms of her artistic pursuits. She's also a printmaker, draftsman, worked in collage, basically a variety of different two-dimensional media. And at the same time, she didn't really like to be described as a painter. She thought of herself, and I think Shtirsky did as well, for both of them, as poets who happen to work in visual media. That's something that I think comes out from their artificialist manifestos. And I think is something that really continues to be the case for Toyin. She's very tied into poetry and poets, and that she is producing these poems in a visual form. There are periods when her work has formal links to various different movements that were happening, like abstract expressionism and op art and pop art. She's certainly not part of any of those movements, but she's certainly doing some things in terms of form that have relationships. So yeah, I think in terms of topics, you have a lot of different continuities stretching throughout her life, but in terms of the formal choices, she has really distinct different periods of time.
And so just to continue with this idea of rupture, continuity, changing, something reading the book, that's, I had the impression of a very protean group of people surrounding Toyin who were all changing almost in unison, or at least responding to different kind of common pressures, ideas, almost at the same time. So much as in Paris, everybody seemed to know everybody in Prague, at least more on the political left of Toyin's generation. And beginning with the Dietzel group, Toyin also seems to have kept really the same network of friends and colleagues, albeit, which was rather curious to me, very few direct competitors as such. And what's similarly curious for me is that the same cohort of personnel of Czech figures, literary figures, artists, in the main cycled through these various movements you just mentioned, albeit with a few breaks, a few vicious debates. It wouldn't be an avant-garde without vicious debates from time to time. And here I'd like to just ask you to comment a little further on Toyin's, her position in the avant-garde as an artist responding to, collaborating with other figures. And is it even appropriate to speak of a growing independence or break, say, especially once we look at her post-war career in France?
Okay, I think first off, I want to say that the cultural world in Prague, and for that matter, Bohemia and Moravia more generally, because we don't want to leave out the city of Brno in Moravia, which was also a very culturally active city. Toyin was part of the Devyatsil group, which had members in both of those cities, and for that matter, elsewhere in Czechoslovakia. But there were also, not only was Devyatsil a very big and very diversified group of people working in a lot of different areas. I mean, you have people that are writers, you have people that are visual artists, you have theater people, you have journalists, you have musicians, you know, kind of every creative pursuit under the sun, architects. But then outside of the Devyatsil group, you also have other groups that are not necessarily considered so avant-garde, but that are definitely modernist. And so, yeah, I mean, people tended to know each other. They definitely did not always agree with one another. But I would say that, yeah, Toyin is very central in a lot of this, that she clearly was involved in a lot of different circles of friendships and collaborators. She was interested in friendship and collaboration, and that really becomes evident in terms of surrealism as well, but it certainly is already the case with Devyatsil, where she's hanging out with a lot of different people and it is, you know, certainly closer to some than to others, but I'm sure we'll also discover friendship links that I'm not aware of. I mean, I was quite interested to find photographs of her with people that that I hadn't realized she was, you know, going out for drinks with and so forth. But I don't know that I would so much say that she becomes independent of these Czechoslovak artistic and intellectual circles when she moves to Paris in the 40s, so much as that she is separated from them. That she and Jindřich Heisler, her second artistic partner, left Czechoslovakia as Czechoslovakia was kind of in the process of going communist. And while she had some contacts continuing with friends from within Czechoslovakia, I think it's really a shift for her, not so much necessarily a intentional separation, but that, you know, she's gone to a whole different country that is also experiencing a lot of ups and downs in terms of strikes and, you know, difficulties post-war. She can't really get, you know, her money, as I understand it, out of Czechoslovakia. So she is not in a very good situation financially. Štyrsky had died during the war. I think there are a lot of things that, you know, where for those of us that are old enough to have different periods in our lives with different groups of friends, we'll kind of understand that it isn't even necessarily that you leave behind or separate yourself from something in your past, as that at a certain point, you're just in a different place, whether emotionally or physically or both. and that you're dealing with your current life. And you may still care about your past life, but it's not there, it's not present in the same way. I will always remember as I was getting ready to go off for graduate school, going for a walk with a friend from one of my writing groups who I'd known for a fair number of years at that point. And I mentioned something or other that related to my life before we had been in that writing group together. And she kind of reacted with great surprise and was kind of like, well, why have you hidden this from us? And I'm kind of like, well, I never hid it from you. It just wasn't part of my life in the time that I've known you. And I suspect that some of that is what was happening for Toyin once Toyin settled in Paris and was getting involved with this new group of surrealists that, well, and then also she had political rifts with some of the people that she left behind, but also some of the people that were from the Paris group that split off, like Eluard, that decided, you know, that they were more interested in communism than they were in surrealism. So there are a lot of different reasons, I think, for this real difference in when she's living in Czechoslovakia prior to moving to Paris permanently.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, to continue a little bit on the lines of French culture and also literature, something that really superbly impressed me reading the monograph Magnetic Woman was just how carefully documented how intertwined art and literature were in interwar Prague, even apart from the later engagements with surrealism with Toyin's friends and her groups. And you very clearly demonstrate throughout the book these common resonances, direct lines of influence, and more. And this particularly extends to French figures such as the Marquis de Sade, Baudelaire, L'Autremont, Rimbaud, Alfred Jarry, Apollinaire, with Čapek's translation of Zone being critical, it seemed, for her entire generation, as well as Freud and even certain German romantics. And here the historian in me wanted to ask, how much did you uncover of Toyin's reading habits? What did you learn about her encounters with the French language? Were there any sort of archival traces here that were able to kind of lead you in certain directions? Or really, how did you kind of attack that problem of what was in the air, really, in terms of kind of literature for Toyin?
That's a great question. On the one hand, I don't know precisely what Toyin read, but I have a pretty good idea of a lot of it. Because while Toyin was not much for writing, Toyin was clearly an extensive reader. Toyin was very, very plugged into poetry in particular. So many of Toyin's friends were poets. Some of them contributed the names to some of her major works. And so I think it is clear that Toyin was reading a lot and probably discussing a lot of this poetry and for that matter, other things that she may have read with writer friends. So for instance, Štýrsky was working on a biography of the Marquis de Sade. She would have been discussing that with him, I am quite sure. He also wrote about other French writers. She's in this very, very literary conscious milieu. And certainly while on the one hand, my understanding is that her French was rather idiosyncratic. She clearly understood French quite well. I mean, she lived in Paris in the 20s for a few years with Schirsky, and then she spent the second half of her life there and was involved with all kinds of poets within the Paris Surrealist group and that were associated with the Paris Surrealist group and collaborated with them. So I think we can say that Toyon was very well read. We just don't know precisely what beyond some of the really obvious figures that I think there is going to be no question that she read. We can say that, you know, she definitely could read in Czech. She could read in French. I would guess that she also could read in German because in interwar Czechoslovakia, we still have a very large German speaking ethnic population. But as to the extent to which she spoke or read German, that I don't know, because you get different attitudes among the Czechs as to whether they really want to explore German. But the Czechs were very, there was a very strong interest in French culture among the Czechs because, and here, I don't want to go too much into the sort of Czech-German cultural history. This is something that a lot of my colleagues in Czech history discuss in their books. And I would encourage people to read books by many of my colleagues like Chad Bryant and Tara Zara, Jeremy King, and so forth. I mean, you have this, on the one hand, Czechs who are very, very Czech nationalist in terms of their language and their linguistic ideas, and then others who are clearly, you know, very bilingual and bicultural. And so without knowing for sure more with Toyon specifically, I don't know to what extent she read or sought out work in German, but certainly Czech and French. And I think she was very well read, at least in terms of poetry.
And now, sticking with the French theme for a little while longer, you paint a really fascinating depiction of an early Parisian interval in Toyon's career from 1928 to 1929. And here you trace a confluence of different social scenes, galleries, magazines, and publishers, all really linked by sexual identifications with lesbianism. And now, even as Toyon's sexuality remains very ambiguous throughout her life, and very purposefully so, as you prove, the alternative intellectual and institutional models here seem important for her in contrast to Prague. So can you tell us a little more here about how Toyon experienced Paris and Prague when there was still a moment of kind of moving between the two?
Well, I think that on the one hand, in Paris in the 20s, there was a pretty significant lesbian cultural scene. The extent to which Toyon participated in this is not known, at least not to me, but the fact that you have major cultural figures, like whether it's Gertrude Stein and her salon, which was fairly multilingual, or Natalie Clifford Barney and her salon, which was more French speaking. You also have writers like Colette, who are clearly more, you know, in the bisexual back and forth kind of realm. And then you have various, various lesbian bars and gay and lesbian bars and so forth. So I think that, you know, this was at least in Paris fairly out in the open for people. Not to say that it was always well regarded by the majority of the French citizenry, but that at least for a time it was something that you could easily find if you were looking for it. Back in Prague, I don't know that it was quite as visible in the 20s. This is something that requires a little more investigation from scholars. We are finding definitely that by the 1930s, you've got the development of a primarily gay male, but open to lesbian contributors like Lida Merlinova, the publications Klaus and Novi Klaus, or Voice and New Voice. And there's definitely a lot of interest in, again, kind of within the context of what was known as sex reformism, making laws better for gay and lesbian people and people of other what were known as sexual minorities. And so by the 30s, that's definitely something that's going on in Czechoslovakia as well. So I think both Prague and Paris are places where this is going on, but it might be going on in terms of social life, maybe a little more earlier in Paris, but we need to, you know, delve more into the situation in Czechoslovakia, because it's clearly happening there too. I mean, Luda Mernová, who was a novelist, and she definitely was writing books that at least some of them could be kind of considered lesbian novels or read with a lesbian eye. So, you know, she's someone that's definitely part of that scene.
And now to perhaps finally turn to the art, as you've been so patient discussing all of these contexts and historical sort of fields around Toyin. To begin with, just your critical language as an art historian, you draw a really fascinating linkage in the book between, and you also apply, a sort of Freudian semiotics, especially of unheimlich or uncanny, the Prague linguistic circle around Jakobson, Prague structuralism, a Prague school of semiotics, and finally, really intriguingly as well, Roger Caillois' series of mimicry. And I found your critical language in the book wholly persuasive. Yet here, as an historian reading an art history, I'd like to ask you if you reflected on using this a sort of period critical language to treat Toyin as well. To perhaps rephrase this in a little more of a blunter manner, did Toyin herself read any of these schools of thoughts and analysis? And how did you reflect on this as you were looking at the actual art that she produced?
Okay, I don't know to what extent Toyin was reading some of the theory, but what I can say is that I know that friends of hers, such as Karl Taiga and Štýrsky and Bohuslav Brok, were definitely reading and writing a lot of this stuff. And the Prague Surrealist group, its members were close to the people in the Prague linguistic circle. So, you know, they were friends with Jakobson and Mukhorshovsky, people like that. And so I think whether or not Toyin was directly sitting down and reading psychoanalysis or reading Jakobson and Mukhorshovsky's theories, she was definitely involved in talking about them. She's in this milieu where people are finding conversation really, you know, they're sitting in cafes talking on a regular basis. And so she may have read some of this. I know that Štýrsky was definitely reading Otto Rank and Freud, and, you know, I mean, this is all in the air at this time. And so whether or not she was directly reading it, she would have been talking about it. And given the fact that the Prague Linguistic School members were close to the Prague Surrealists, I would guess that probably some of the theory is developing in the minds of people like Jakobson and Mukhorshovsky as a result of speaking with Toyin and Štýrsky and other people in the group. I mean, like Jindřich Honzel, the theater director and theorist, was also a member of both groups. He was both a founding Prague Surrealist and a member of the Prague Linguistic School, and wrote, you know, semiotic things about theater. And so, you know, again, this is something that Toyin is just in the midst of. So I don't think it really matters whether she sat there and read the texts. She was going to be in the middle of it, be thinking about it, being, you know, probably influencing some of it through her artwork.
And now it's a challenge for any interview, even on the New Books Network, to describe artworks visually, even as the book itself is really a magnificent production from the University of Pittsburgh. It includes a generous selection of colored plates, black and white illustrations accompanying the text throughout. So here I would like to ask you how you chose the works that you did to reproduce in the book, and also to ask further whether there was a fairly stable personal visual language for Toyin but you felt able to represent with the selections. You mentioned in the book, childhood is a nightmare, emptiness and insubstantiality, with headlessness, ghosts. You have your idea of a late imagery of desires, shadows and spaces. So just to recap that question, I'd like to ask you just how you picked what you showed in the book, what you analyzed, and also invite you to tell us a little bit about one painting or artwork in particular that you felt really helped you understand Toyin and helped to create this book.
Okay. Well, in terms of how I chose things, how I chose images to put in the book, part of it depended on what I had access to. And the process of seeking the images was a dreadfully long and rather painful one. On the one hand, I was very lucky in that the collector Mary Cullen was very kind to me and allowed me great access to her collection of books and ephemera and so forth that she had by Toyin and the Prague Surrealists, and she was fine with me photographing and scanning materials. Also, a collector in New York who works with a friend of mine, I was able to get access to, again, some of the printed materials. And I also was able to, you know, work with libraries and archives for book illustrations and things that were, you know, maybe not the, you know, original drawing, but the way it was, but the way something was shown in a publication in Toyin's lifetime. Various museums kindly gave me digital copies of artworks that I was able to use. And I also took some photographs of my own in museums, but ultimately it kind of came down to wanting to give at least some overview of the richness of Toyin's artwork, that on the one hand, the book is more tilted toward the Czech context that Toyin, you know, is kind of formed by, and also focusing more on the idea of eroticism, but I didn't want to leave out other aspects of Toyin's work. So I tried to include, you know, a variety of different media, so not just paintings, but also book illustrations and prints and collage. And I wanted to, partly because there's not really much of anything else written in English at this point, or at least that's available in English-speaking countries. I mean, you really have to travel to the Czech Republic to get some of what is in English. I really wanted to try and give readers even a broader sense of what Toyin's work looked like than necessarily what I was focusing on in the text. So yeah, I ended up having more images than technically I was supposed to, and therefore the book is, I'm afraid, more expensive than we originally planned, but such is life. I am very happy with what University of Pittsburgh Press was able to do with the images that I did collect, even though we were not making a coffee table book.
And just to return again to those artworks, is there one in particular that you think might help kind of work as—
Oh, that's right. Yes. One of the works that I think is a really nice one to discuss, even though it's a relatively late work, but that pulls together a lot of the things that I talk about at different times in the book and themes that are significant for Toyin, is a work from 1966. So when she's been in Paris for almost 20 years, that is alternately called Le Paravent, or The Folding Screen. And this is an oil painting with some collage. It hasn't got a lot of collage, but it's got a little bit of collage in that it's showing, you know, the kind of folding screen that used to be, I think, fairly common for people to dress behind, and that people still occasionally have in their homes more as a decorative element. And we see this very ghostly, shadowy figure that is relatively feminine looking, although not necessarily, but more feminine than masculine looking, in the center, faceless, more like a kind of a white smoke or whitish smoke or fog, that is clothed in these sort of leopard or cheetah beings, and is either taking off or putting on a pair of green gloves. And the feline figure in the lower part of the image has a collaged human woman's mouth with bright red lipstick, kind of almost snarling at us. And then off to the sides, we have these two shadowy figures that are more, you know, again, they're not defined as masculine or feminine, but we can probably think of them as perhaps more masculine because they don't have any kind of feminine symbolism on them. You know, they're not wearing gloves. We can't tell what kind of clothing they have. There's no sign of breasts, etc. And then up at the very top, we've got this collage of a pair of mating butterflies. So it's a beautifully mysterious work. It relates very well to this period of the 60s in Toyin's work, where there are a lot of these ghostly figures, particularly these sort of evanescent kind of female figures floating about, and use of animal imagery that often connects with the female. So I think it's just a wonderful painting. And it's one of my favorites, although I have a lot of favorites. And it's one that that can be seen at the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville Paris in Paris. Not sure whether it's on display at the moment or not, but in fact, it's probably circulating with the Toyin show that's currently in Germany, but I'm not sure of that. At any rate, it's really quite a misty, mysterious, haunting sort of evocation. So I encourage people to look for that among other exciting works.
Now, one question I had as well, drawing up my list, reading your book, and looking at the book subtitle, Toyin and the Surrealist Erotic, I also wondered if her career wouldn't also help us to distinguish between various sorts of eroticism, almost if we have our avant-garde's, one proceeding after another, overlapping, taking from it. We also have eroticisms kind of floating around in the background. Again, I drew up my list. We have a Czech eroticism, a Fin de siècle eroticism, a Habsburg eroticism, Surrealist eroticism, French eroticism, and finally a sort of personal eroticism, which I think came out in your description of that one painting. And do these categories or even labels help us to really kind of understand different phases of Toyin's career? Or is that really just a historian pushing too much into art history?
I think there maybe you're pushing a little far. I think different artists have certainly their own erotic directions. Not to say that those can't be culturally specific, because obviously they are. I mean, there's certainly things that I would associate with fin de siècle eroticism, but I don't know. I think Toyin has a very, very individual approach to eroticism, that it's very very polymorphous in the Freudian sense. And of course, Toyin was familiar with Freud's ideas. You know, it's not specifically, it's certainly not a male gaze, although the female figure is certainly very visible in it, but I don't know that it's necessarily a specifically lesbian gaze. I think it's very mutable. And yeah, I think I'll leave that there and perhaps let people after me contemplate that particular question a little further.
And I think there is a point here that you elaborate in the book, in that she does certain things that her male colleagues don't. Would you care to comment a bit further on that?
Yeah. Certainly in terms of the way in which she is working with eroticism, there's a lot of phallic imagery. Now in the Czech context, there is a certain amount of phallic imagery, among male artists, but not for public consumption so much. It's more kind of, you know, like their private, you know, caricatures and so forth that do to some extent get published in Shklovsky's briefly published journal, Erotitska Revue, where he was exploring different kinds of eroticism. So, I mean, you know, you have, for instance, you know, sketches of, you know, like the guy with a violin bow playing on his penis and so forth. So, but she's playing with the phallic imagery in a, I think, in a different playful kind of manner. And then I think she also really gives us much more vaginal imagery. I mean, the phallic imagery really jumps out. It's very obvious, but the more you look at, especially the later work, there's I think a very strong tendency to explore vaginal imagery in ways that are not, they're no longer sort of what we might think of as verging on the pornographic or whatever. That they're very surreal, very you know, associated with these phantoms and so forth. So I think those are some things that she does a bit differently.
Now, one great hope for this interview as we start to begin to draw to a close is that it brings Toyn to the attention of English speakers in America, other art historians. But I think it's also fair to say that there's been a resurgence of interest in her generation, both in the Czech Republic, with the advent, as you mentioned, of a retrospective of her work, as well as her generation more broadly speaking, here in English, works like Derek Sayers, Prague, Capital of the 20th Century, Thomas Ort's Art and Life in Modernist Prague come to mind. So how would you describe Toyn's work as appealing to audiences today as much as to historians, art historians like yourself?
I do think that there's been a strong interest. And I think one thing that's happening is that as people, for instance, art students, many of my students are art majors. I have some students who are art history majors, but it's more studio art majors. They're discovering not just the Czech modernists and the surrealists, but I also show them, for instance, some of the Polish modernists and Hungarian modernists, and they're just blown away. They're like, this is, you know, amazing. I really like this stuff. And I think this is something that is definitely happening in the English speaking world as more and more scholars and museums are getting a handle on some of this work and these artists that had kind of gotten lost behind the former Iron Curtain. That, you know, there are linguistic reasons that, you know, scholarship from some of the countries like Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic and Slovakia, or Hungary, or Poland, were not really, you know, we weren't getting a lot of scholarship out of those areas in languages that most of us could read until more recently. And now with scholars, you know, as English becomes more of, I hate to say it, a lingua franca, it just seems terrible to say anything but French is a lingua franca, but that is the role English currently has. And so scholars from a multitude of countries are writing in English, but also Anglophone scholars are able increasingly to read in the languages of Central and Eastern Europe. And so there is being more of an understanding in terms of museum exhibitions. So for instance, places like MoMA in New York or the Tate Modern to be inclusive. And with those of us who are art historians that are writing about some of these areas and some of these artists, along with the museum exhibitions, I think this really helps bring some of this temporarily forgotten work into the public eye, and people discover it and are excited by it. So I think it's a very exciting time. And I think there will be, you know, an increase in, you know, scholarship, especially as more people are learning the languages. I mean, like, for instance, we have a lot of, you know, what we would refer to as heritage speakers of, you know, whether it's Russian or Czech or Polish, whatnot, who are also, you know, totally fluent in English. and who are interested in exploring the art and culture of their, you know, their parents' or grandparents' countries. And so I think we can look forward to a really interesting future of lots more research.
Well, let's hope that your book is really the entrance point for a lot of people to discover this world and even worlds that you sketch out within it. And now, to conclude, having finished this wonderful monograph, can you tell us a little bit about your current research?
Okay, well, in terms of research, I'm doing a couple of things. On the one hand, I've been working on an anthology of translations of Czech modernist texts between about 1900 and 1950 on art, aesthetics, architecture, visual culture. These are things that have been already translated, but that you would kind of have to be a specialist to know that they were there and go find them. I'm also making some improvements in some of the translations and annotating them. So this is something that I'm currently looking for a publisher for. I think it's something that could make a really, really nice contribution for people who are not specialists in Czech modernism to become more familiar with it and use it in their teaching. I'm also starting to look a little bit more into Toyin and the esoteric, which is being quite fun. I'm not expecting to do a book on that, but doing, as I mentioned, a conference paper on it. And also have done a lot of work on Czech visual culture that might end up being a book. And then not as a researcher, but in the other part of my life, I am doing novels. And so I have a novel coming out next year from Regal House. So that is also a big part of what's coming up for me. And I do want to also, kind of give a shout out to all of those younger researchers who are kind of coming up as new voices in the scholarship on Central and Eastern Europe, on Surrealism, on a lot of things that have been neglected before. For instance, I'm currently reading Amy Hale's book on the British Surrealist Eithel Colquhoun. We've also got a couple of, graduate students working on Toyin topics, and I'm really looking forward to hearing some of their work in the very near future. And as I was saying just a moment ago, I think the future is looking really bright for people doing research. I don't know whether the future is bright for job prospects for people. That's a whole other problem. But so long as a person is able to get some amount of support and funding and so forth, I think there are a lot of areas that I think there can be a lot more research on Toyin, especially looking at some of her French colleagues and context. And I think that's been the new exhibition that was in Prague over the summer and is now in Hamburg and will be in Paris, that has some very interesting work on the Paris period. So I'm hoping to see more of that in the future.
So with this wonderful interview, then, I would like to recommend to all New Book Network listeners this is a fantastic book from Professor Carla Hubner on the magnetically fascinating artist Toyin. Thank you for your time, Professor Hubner, and thank you for listening.
And thank you.